You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Underrepresented music, local voices, and real people. You keep CJSF independent.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Water loss on land adds to rising seas. Global drying with gravity satellite expert Jay Famiglietti. Is this planet actually a living cooperative? Explore with science journalist Ferris Jaber. Expect abrupt shifts in big systems from ocean currents to ice. New science led by Sjoerd Terpstra. Three interviews. Let's get busy. We know why sea levels are rising around the world. Hotter oceans mean thermal expansion, and warmer pools are dumping extra water from melting glaciers. Except, now we find out there is a third source of new water into the sea, and it's bigger than each of those. From deep underground to lakes, human actions are pushing Earth's land water into decline. Think what that means for crops, drinking water, and all living things. The paper published July 24th in Science Advances is titled Unprecedented Continental Drying, Shrinking Freshwater Availability, and Increasing Land Contributions to Sea Level Rise. We reached co-author Dr. James J. Famiglietti. He is the former director of the Global Institute for Water Security at the University of Saskatchewan and previous senior water scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena. From California, J. Famiglietti, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much for having me.
We all heard that wet places get wetter and dry get drier as the world warms, but we pictured some kind of balance. How did your team discover land water sources are actually decreasing?
We used 22 years of satellite data from the NASA GRACE, which stands for Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment Missions. GRACE allows us to track how water storage on the continents and in the ocean and on the ice sheets varies over time. And because we've been monitoring it for over two decades with these satellites, we can see the long-term trends. And that allowed us to see this very startling picture of an increasing amount of continental drying. You mentioned the wet areas getting wetter and the dry areas getting drier. And that's only partially true now. At high latitudes, which used to be under the wet areas get wetter umbrella, we found that those places are melting and permafrost is thawing, and they too are getting drier.
When you and I talked in 2014, you told us about declining groundwater under the big food-producing state of California. Did last year's atmospheric rivers replenish groundwater supplies there? What is the state of California's water supplies 10 years later?
It's about 10 years worse. We wrote a paper at the end of 2022 that showed that groundwater levels were declining at an accelerating pace rather than slowing down, which one might expect in response to the passage of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. The long-term picture in California and in a lot of our food-producing regions is that we use so much water that those regions, those aquifers that underlie those regions, will never be replenished. They get a little replenishment during those wet periods, but that will never compensate for the continued groundwater use during the dry periods.
At least a billion people depend on pumping groundwater, especially as drought becomes more common. On the North Indian Plains, farmers are drilling 100 feet, 30 meters to get water and having to go deeper. How serious is the human role in draining water that accumulated over millennia below ground?
I think that it's poorly appreciated how much a role humans are playing in the continental drying that we report on in the paper. And specifically, I'm talking about groundwater depletion. That's a human decision. It's one that we could cut back on. In California, I live in Arizona now. You know, when I used to live in Saskatchewan, around the world, we are making a decision to pump far more groundwater than is available to us on an annual renewable basis, and it's led to this huge decline that we reported in the paper. So the humans are having an undeniable role, and one that we could actually choose to scale back on.
Your study raises another red flag. For years, scientists predicted the far north forests in Canada and Russia would get wetter as the Earth heats up, and you mentioned that. What did you find? I mean, why is this not going to happen?
So last time we wrote a big paper like this one, which was 2018, we had analyzed data, say, from 2002 to 2016. And we did show in those papers that the high-latitude areas were getting wetter and the mid-latitudes were getting drier, just as predicted by the climate models that are used around the world. In this paper, we had an additional 10 years or so of data, and we found that things have really changed, especially over the last decade, and especially at high latitudes. Those are regions that are warming at about four times the global rate, and that's leading directly to snow and ice melt and permafrost thaw. And those phenomena are not really well represented in the climate model. So it's not a surprise to me that the models don't predict it, because the processes are not embedded in the models. The pace of the ice and snow melt and the thawing of the permafrost and its pathway to the ocean to drive sea level rise are not well represented in our models.
Well, here's something that was giving me mental exclamation marks in my brain as I was reading your new paper. Talk to us about the rapid expansion of dry areas and the emergence of mega drying regions.
So again, when we published our last big papers on this topic, and we had a couple of big ones in 2018 and 2016, when we have constructed what we call our global trend map, this global picture of the places that are getting wetter and getting drier, in the places that were getting drier, it was more distinct hotspots and not necessarily interconnected. Over the last 10 years or so, and I keep mentioning this 10-year inflection point around 2014, which was the timing of the biggest El Nino ever recorded. And right about that time then, we start seeing a rapid increase in the areas around the world that are experiencing extreme drying, more frequent drought. And sort of a complementary impact, we see less of the world getting wetter. So what we're seeing is that the rate of drying is increasing. The area that's experiencing drying and extreme drying is increasing at about two-tenths the size of California each year. And that's being compensated for by the shrinking of the areas that are getting wetter. That also leads then to the connection on a map of the previously very distinct hotspots. And so now when you look between the hotspots, you see a lot more drying. For example, it might be in the United States, California, and the Ogallala Aquifer. And they would have really popped out on a map before. Now, if you look at that global map, you see just a mass of drying across the southwestern U.S., into Mexico, down into Central America, and up even into the northwestern U.S. And so that's led to what we call these mega drying regions. That was an effort on my part to really try to communicate the expanse of the drying and how much it's changed over the last decade.
And the new paper in Science Advances maps out four huge regions of land water loss. The one that caught my eye was in Asia. Could you describe sort of what that mega region includes?
Well, that's a huge region. I mean, it basically goes from northern Africa to northern Europe and from western Europe all the way across to Southeast Asia. And it, I think, underscores the expansion of these drying regions from, again, just a small collection of hotspots to a massively interconnected drying landscape. It's, you know, it's basically first steps towards land degradation and desertification. So we really need to be paying attention to this and responding to it at a global scale.
Why didn't I find mega drying in the southern hemisphere like Australia?
That's a good question. And so we are trying to figure that out. And in the paper, we actually talk about an oscillation, a switch from drying happening mostly in the southern hemisphere to drying happening mostly in the northern hemisphere. So there could be a fundamental change in the climate system, a new oscillation that we point to in the paper. And that is something we're working on right now.
We also have listeners in the UK and Europe. Both have been drier than normal over the past few years, especially Britain. It's remarkable what's happened there this year. And that's a factor in the wildfires there. What did you find out about water loss in Europe, Jay?
Again, relative to these earlier papers that I keep mentioning, we found that the occurrence of drought, especially over the last 10 years in Europe, has really sort of hit Europe quite hard and attached it to this mega region. And that's one of the main reasons for the expansion compared to previous papers was what's been happening in Europe. And of course, when you go there, I was just out there in Stockholm and I've done a lot of work in Germany. And, you know, it's clear. It's not just something that we're seeing from satellites. It's being experienced, of course, quite significantly on the ground.
Well, let's picture the process, perhaps an agribusiness operation irrigating vast fields with water pumped from underground. So that water evaporates up into the sky and somehow it adds to sea level rise. Why doesn't it just fall again as rain on land?
So there's two things that are happening. So when we pump water out of the ground, what really happens? Well, some of it is embedded in the plant. Some of it infiltrates back down into the ground. A lot of it runs off into rivers and streams that ultimately drain into the ocean. And yes, there's an increase in evaporation. The issue with evaporation in the atmosphere is that the atmosphere doesn't actually store a tremendous amount of water. So it might rain out on land, but ultimately it ends up collecting in the ocean. So again, it points to the lack of storage capacity in the atmosphere and the ocean being this ultimate collector for additional water in the water cycle.
Okay, so after a steady diet of ice walls crashing into the sea in Greenland and Antarctica, it's a shock to find even more sea level rise comes from land water loss. If that's true, is water storage in lakes and reservoirs also decreasing?
Yes, it is. It's the thing about water storage in reservoirs is that it's another human decision, and it's managed by humans, but it certainly fluctuates with how the climate fluctuates. You know, I guess the difference I like to say is one of the big differences between surface water and groundwater is that surface waters in our rivers and our lakes and stored in our reservoirs fluctuates. It goes up and down. There's wet periods, there's dry periods. We've got a human management aspect to it. But for the most part, with groundwater, the groundwater just disappears. We use so much of it that we're not replacing it with what happens on the surface.
Your paper does not contain the words peak water, but groundwater and reservoirs can run out. Iran just ran dry. Cities in many parts of the world approached 0 day or had to truck in water. What do you think, Jay? Is peak water a valid worry, or is it too soon for that?
I hesitate to invoke the term peak water because it implies that we know how much groundwater we have, and we actually don't, and that's kind of a startling fact. We know that, of course, we're having huge impacts on the landscape through groundwater depletion. We've got subsidence of the ground surface. We've got falling water tables, degrading water quality, impacts on biodiversity, depleting rivers. So the impacts are all negative. But we don't actually know how much water we have, and that's a challenge. So I tend to stay away from the term peak water, but I will say that there's been a number of studies that have shown that we are well past using easily accessible groundwater.
Why does your team exclude Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets from your definition of continental drying?
That's more a sea level construct. The sea level community likes to split those off, and because they're so huge, because they're such major contributors to sea level rise, also because they're well measured not only by the Grace satellites, but by other satellites. So it really sort of helps us fit into the well-established sea level change studies that are embedded in the global change community.
Well, would it be true to say this generation is burning through water essential for life that cannot be replaced? I mean, is this another generational issue where humans are kind of using up the future?
Certainly it is with respect to groundwater. Groundwater is an intergenerational resource. It took, you know, tens of thousands and more years to accumulate that water in the world's aquifers, and in most cases around the world, we're burning through it in about a century. We are putting future generations and current generations at risk, and that's an important message for people to really understand. We need to be thinking about, in every country around the world, how we can sustain this groundwater for future generations, and it is particularly important in the drying regions of the world where, in my opinion, you know, especially in the already arid regions that are getting drier. In my opinion, groundwater is the most precious natural resource, and you're right, we're burning through it at far too rapid a clip.
Your paper does end with a call to action. Your team attempts to separate that action from the slower-moving climate change to the active problem of continental drying. How would that work? And on a practical level, Jay, what can be done better?
Around the world, I think that every country and states and provinces within countries around the world really need to think carefully about their groundwater management. In many places around the world, the monitoring and the management of groundwater is weak and in some cases non-existent. And so that has to change. At the global scale, it's really, really important that we elevate water in the global change discussions that are had by that are held by the UN, for example, the COP meetings that happen every year, the Bonn Climate Conference that happens every year. There's Climate Week in New York that's happening in a couple of weeks. We need to elevate the discussion of water and the rapidly changing water availability, rapidly increasing water security, and all the issues that are associated with it to the level of carbon dioxide. That's what I would like to see happen, and that's one thing that I'm working hard to do.
Yes, you've been working, studying hidden water reserves for a long time. What are you working on next, and where do you see the next frontier?
That's an excellent question, because I feel like with this paper, I've really sort of made the transition to the action phase of my career. Scientifically, we're always trying to improve our methods. We're trying to bring together more and more satellites. There's higher resolution satellites now available through the private sector. So we're trying to combine those things also with machine learning and AI to do the best job we possibly can. So we're always working on that. We're always working on improving our resolution in space and time, so that we can get down to the scale, say a 1 kilometer scale, at which water management decisions are made around the world. We are always working very carefully with and very hard with stakeholders, with our departments of water resources, whether I've lived both in California and Arizona. So trying to do a lot locally and then globally, again, really turning my attention to and trying to build community and connect communities that are trying to elevate the awareness of water and elevate its stature within these global climate discussions.
From Arizona, we've been speaking with Dr. Jay Famiglietti. And Jay helped publish a revealing new study titled Unprecedented Continental Drying, Shrinking Freshwater Availability, and Increasing Land Contributions to Sea Level Rise. You can find links, notes, and quotes in my show blog every Wednesday at ecoshock.org. Jay, thank you so much for sharing time with our listeners.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Radio EcoShock.
Living things can be found deep in the rock and floating high in the atmosphere. As life and this planet blend together, does a new level of being emerge? What or who is Gaia? All this is professionally explored by Ferris Jaber in his book Becoming Earth, A Journey Through the Hidden Wonders That Bring Our Planet to Life. Ferris publishes articles with The New Yorker, The Atlantic, National Geographic, and Scientific American. He has received fellowships from major American universities. From Portland, Oregon, Ferris Jaber, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, let's first travel to the places we don't go, and then we will tackle the bigger picture of Gaia. How can anything live deep underground in the rock and never see sunlight or water from the clouds?
Yeah, it's truly astonishing just how much life is living very deep within the rocky crust of the planet. Just a few decades ago, scientists didn't really think anything lived down there, and it now turns out that perhaps the majority of microbes, of microorganisms on the planet, may live within the planet's rocky crust. And it turns out that this crust is not just solid rock. It's actually perfused with all kinds of fissures and cracks that are full of water. And in general, wherever you find water, you find life. Now, because these microbes are cut off from sunlight and from easy access to oxygen, they've had to find different ways of making energy and sustaining themselves. So they've learned to essentially breathe and eat the rocks and metals and minerals around them.
A few years ago, we talked with microbiologist David Saylor. He said, not only do we not have any map or catalog of microscopic life, but such a project is impossible because new organisms can appear in a day among billions of species. So Gaia inventor James Lovelock would ask, what is the purpose of this underground life? How does it tie into the overall project? Do you have any ideas on that?
Well, I think one thing that's particularly interesting about these so-called intraterrestrial microbes is that they may be some of the living microbes today that are most similar to what life looked like billions of years ago. You know, when single-celled organisms first emerged billions of years ago, they may have emerged in parallel in multiple places on the planet. So they may have started out in the deep crust, in the deep ocean, perhaps on the surface. And they may have had very unusual ways of making a living and getting energy that is, you know, not as common today. So the, you know, the microbes that we're most familiar with may not be the ones that most closely resemble what the earliest life forms looked like. So I think that these microbes that live really far away from us are in some ways a window into the past. They're a way for us to time travel and see what life might have been like a long time ago when the Earth was very different from today.
And some people think, well, maybe the first life traveled to Earth buried in an asteroid. What do you think? Is there any science around this, or is it just an idea?
It seems to have sort of remained mostly an idea. You know, it's certainly not entirely implausible. We know that sometimes really massive rocks enter our planet's atmosphere, and they leave giant chunks, you know, meteorites the size of boulders on the surface. So if something that large can survive the journey and there is life embedded within it, you know, that is a possibility. But there's no really clear, compelling evidence that that is the case, that that is how life first emerged here. So I think most scientists don't really put that much stock in that notion.
Well, going to the other extreme, when we look up in the sky, we don't usually think there's a lot of living things up there, but there are. And along those lines, scientists discovered trees in the Amazon can stimulate their own weather. And you wrote about this. Amazon rainforests even influence weather in the northern hemisphere. Could you talk about how that might work?
Yeah, so the Amazon rainforest generates about half of the rain that falls on its canopy each year. And it really involves all of the life in the forest. So the trees and plants are collectively pulling huge volumes of water from the soil with their roots and then releasing what they don't use to the atmosphere. So saturating the air with huge volumes of water vapor. And at the same time, the forest is breathing out this potpourri of tiny biological particles, things like microbes and pollen grains and fungal spores. And the water vapor combines and condenses on all of those little particles, which is how clouds form. So the life being, you know, breathed out of the forest combined with all the water vapor dramatically accelerates cloud formation and the rain cycle. And this generates a massive flying river of precipitation that travels throughout South America. And then because the atmosphere is one big entity and it's all interconnected, what happens over one continent affects what's happening elsewhere in the world. So this massive flying river generated by the Amazon is having these ripple effects, these teleconnections through the atmosphere, and is influencing precipitation as far away as Canada and the Pacific Northwest.
And I really enjoyed in your book the description of going up the Measuring Tower, the highest human-made structure in South America. Why is it there, and what was it like?
Yes, the Amazon Tall Tower Observatory is in the heart of the Amazon rainforest in a protected area, and scientists come from all over the world to climb it and to study the relationship between the atmosphere and the forest. And it's basically like a giant utility tower, a massive steel staircase in the middle of the rainforest. And so you have to be harnessed onto it, onto the railing as you climb up, just in case you slip through one of the many gaps. And when you make it to the top, which takes a few hours of climbing, you are literally halfway between the treetops, the canopy, and the clouds. And you can see this process of the Amazon making its own rain and clouds happen. You can see the mist coming off of the forest, rising up, forming the clouds, and then falling back down again as rain. And it's a really interesting place to build a research station because it's protected. The air is a lot cleaner and more pure than in other parts of the world. And so you can really see, you know, what the atmosphere is like just in relationship to the forest as opposed to industry.
I guess you couldn't go up there in high wind situations.
No, and you have to be careful about the weather and storms. You know, you don't want to be on this giant lightning rod in the middle of a thunderstorm. So if it does start to get too rainy and stormy, you need to hike back down really quickly.
It's so weird to think the upper air is alive with living things that can travel and maybe reproduce far away. How would you describe life in the atmosphere?
Yeah, I think of it as heaven's microbiome. You know, we know that we and all complex living creatures are ecosystems. We're walking ecosystems. We have microorganisms in and on and around us all the time. And the same is really true of all bodies, all ecosystems throughout our planet. We used to think that there wasn't any life up in the clouds, but it turns out that microbes are continually being whisked off of the land and sea and up into the air because they are so tiny and essentially weightless. And once they get up there, they can actually hang around and form communities for weeks to months, even sometimes eating or reproducing within the clouds and then returning to the surface in precipitation, in rain and snow and hail. So scientists have found microbes inside hailstones and snow crystals and rain all over the world. And some of these microbes are actually actively changing the weather. There's a particular bacterium that has proteins on its surface that actually encourage liquid water molecules to freeze into a solid ice crystal. So it can start these chain reactions of crystallization within rain clouds. And when it does that, it makes the clouds much larger and heavier much really quickly, and that encourages them to fall as rain, as precipitation. So it actually helps the microbes return to the surface. So they've potentially evolved these strategies to, deal with constantly being whisked up into the atmosphere and then getting back down to the ground, and in the process are changing the meteorology of the whole planet.
Well, let's approach this concept of Gaia. Does that name point to a super system, a new type of being, or how do you see it?
Well, when Lovelock initially was writing about Gaia in the 70s and 80s, he did often call it a being. He would sometimes call it a superorganism. But over time, James Lovelock and his many collaborators, including the American biologist Lynn Margulis, they refined their ideas. They clarified what they were talking about. And the modern evolution is to think of Earth as an interconnected living system. it's not a superorganism. It's actually the largest known living system. It's one big interconnected system in which all the animate and inanimate parts are working in concert. And it is analogous to,